Support for COVID Riff comes from Ulmer's Drug and Hardware, offering a wide variety of immunizations, including the COVID-19 vaccine. Appointment scheduling online on the Ulmer's website, proudly serving the Homer community since 1977. Additional support for COVID Riff comes from South Peninsula Hospital, reminding listeners testing for COVID-19 helps slow the spread. If experiencing any related symptom, get tested with easy drive-up testing from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at 4201 Bartlett Street, the lower level of the specialty clinic.
Hello everyone, welcome to COVID Riff, segment 5. I'm Rob Downey, Family Practice MD and Institute for Functional Medicine Certified Practitioner. And my co-host is Lauren Carroll, Public Health Nurse 3, and a fellow at the Johns Hopkins Master's in Public Health Program. Morning, Lauren.
Hey, Rob.
Beautiful day in Homer.
It is. I used to think, actually, I was thinking just before we connected, I used to hate Sundays, but now I love them. That's kind of one of the funny things about, maybe we can just jump right in. That's one of the funny things about thinking about determinants of health is then I start thinking about everything as a determinant of health. I used to hate Sundays because I had this job that I didn't really like a whole lot. And yeah, I had a hard time getting along with the people I worked with, so Sundays meant Mondays coming right up, and that was tough. Thankfully, I haven't had to deal with that in a long time.
Well, I think part of what's been neat about having this set of discussions is that it can be very good for all of us to think outside the box and kind of challenge or stretch the envelope. So I've been doing things differently, in ways that maybe serve me a little better or are refinements in my system because of our conversations. So I feel really fortunate that I'm getting to have them.
Oh, that's great.
I'll share a little bit then about some ideas this week. And so today's theme, I'm going to talk a little bit about supplements, but I think that today's theme is like, where's the yield? And what I mean by that is that another thing I've learned from this class is I've asked myself, I think what's a public health question, which is how can the most people be the most healthy? And I think folks look at a functional medicine doctor or they'll talk to a functional medicine patient or they'll just see people who are well enough off that they can afford good supplements. And it can feel like from the outside looking in, like, gosh, it'd be nice to be that person who can afford professional grade supplements. And so my good news for everybody today is that they can be super healthy without them. And the one thing I did want people to know, I've kept encouraging people if they want to go to ifm.org/COVID-19, if they want to see the supplements that have data about mitigating getting COVID or mitigating the course. But first, people should talk to their medical provider if they're going to take supplements. And secondly, there is something really interesting, which is that the best companies, the way they've come up with a way to make supplements that are safe, essentially pharmaceutical grade, is they do this third-party testing. So the first party is the consumer or customer. The second party is the manufacturer. And the third party is a lab that's paid to randomly test the supplement, publish the data regardless of whether or not it's favorable to the company or not. So people ever do want to check out any of these supplements after talking to their medical provider, they could go and see if their supplement is third-party tested. I just wanted to remember to share that. Really, food is the way our body expects things to come in. And there's this idea in functional medicine that the body knows the way. And so when we have our zinc or our selenium or our vitamin C or what have you come in as food, that's kind of how our body's expecting to see it. There's some interesting advantages to that. And this takes me into this related issue then of thinking about one person versus many. So I have the privilege of getting to help one person get better at a time. I love that. I'll never quit loving doing that. But I think our program is about sort of the many. And there, I think you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And even though that's such an old saw, it's so true. And so to me, the yield is about what can we do again to talk today in session six about what are the highest yield things that people can do. And so today I'm going to expand a little on what we did in that session with Tommy Tomato and Christy Carrot about just how people can get the things that they would get from supplements, from food, and I'll do that at the end. But the part I would love it if you would educate us all about is, again, in terms of where's the yield, you know, can you start teaching us about things like how we figure out what delivers benefit from the perspective of community health needs assessments, state health needs assessments, the history of DHS, DPN, you know, is that a good thing to do next for people to understand sort of how we got here and where we're going?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure thing. I'll take a stab at it. You know, I feel like here's a repeat alert here. I very much feel like a student myself learning all these things. But also it's been kind of interesting and fun during this six-session journey. I feel like we're coming around full circle to episode six. So a couple more dots along the journey here before we make it full circle. But yeah, you know, as a nurse, they teach us in universities to think about the nursing process. And that has several steps. It makes a circle. You come back around and keep doing the same things. And there's a few components there. One is to plan, go ahead and do something, evaluate what you've done, and then keep going. And that particular approach is embedded in different concepts and also different approaches to improving community health. One of those is simply a community health needs assessment. And so it kind of brings up the, you know, a lot of really important points is if there are so many determinants of health, how do we know what it is that we're doing is doing good? So one way to do that would be to conduct and then point at a community health needs assessment. And you know, down here in Southern Kenai Peninsula in central Alaska, we've been in the community has been in the community health needs business since about 2008. And that's thanks to really the hospital, but also that was in response to IRS guidelines allowing nonprofit hospitals to basically get a tax break if they were to assess the health of a community. But down here, what that means starting in 2008 is the hospital did a key thing is they called up the public health nurse office and asked them, hey, who should we have at the table as we're starting this community health needs assessment process? And I think we mentioned this before in a previous session, that assessment or population health that's determined at that time, that snapshot, is what's used to build community health improvement plans. And here's the interesting thing is state health assessments, we have one here in the state of Alaska. It's called Healthy Alaskans 2030, and we usually look at updating that every 10 years or so. And that's a partnership between Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and also the state of Alaska. And those metrics or items within the state health assessment are very high level. And there's also a national one called Healthy People 2030. So the great thing about all these assessments is if you can align them. And what I mean by aligning is what we do or look at in the state health assessment and the national health assessment differs in terms of the specific interventions at the local level, but you can line them all up for a bigger impact. That's a little bit of background behind that. So if you're able to connect the dots or align Healthy People 2030, Healthy Alaskans 2030, clear down to the local level, the community health needs assessment, then you're really set up for success in regards to promoting community health and creating a united front to improving these determinants of health.
That's so cool. It sounds like they kind of synergize or potentiate one another.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's just started in 2008. You know, so it's still relatively a new approach to improving community health, you know, here in central Alaska. But, you know, you'd also asked about the history of DHSS, the Department of Health and Social Services. And, you know, one of our earliest roots or signs of an organized public health system was probably back in 1893 when we had the emergence of the first public health nurse in the state. So this is well before statehood. And so we've been in existence as public health nurses in the state more as public health nurses of a territory than we have been of a state. And so then, of course, during statehood, with ratification of the Constitution, that's kind of where the heart of our existence as public health is today, where the Constitution says that it's the state's responsibility to promote and protect the health of the public. And there are several Alaska statutes that also support that as well.
There's some deep old roots there.
Yeah. And it kind of keeps going, you know, since statehood to now, lots of changes have happened, you know, from 1893 to statehood, and then several decades thereafter, the public health nurses focused on individuals. Also, what has happened throughout the state through that time is the needs of communities have changed. So public health nurses have morphed to mirror or parallel those changes. Probably one of the biggest changes in the state has been the creation of the community health aid program. So what that did effectively is increased access to almost every Alaska Native village by putting a medical home in the village that's run primarily by Alaska Natives. So what that meant was that the public health nurses out in the bush had less of a need to provide primary care. And that was kind of the beginnings of public health nurses shifting to population-focused health care in 2004, and then it became official around 2009 or 2010.
I'm really glad we got to go into that so much, Session 2. And I'm also glad it reminded me of Session 2 because there was something I wanted to stop and linger longer on, but we were on another thread. But you mentioned when we recorded Session 2 what great shape we were in for the proportion of the Alaska Native community that had been immunized and also our statewide success. And I just think we should pause for a moment, kind of linger longer and be, you know, a moment of gratitude because this is such a victory. It's also a chance for me to just let everybody know that I absolutely, as a functional medicine doctor and family practice MD, have been immunized myself. I've had the Pfizer vaccine dose 2. I'm over 3 weeks out from that, and I'm so grateful for that. I strongly recommend it. I'm a little frustrated with some of the, you know, I understand people's concerns, but I'm unequivocally for it, and I'm super familiar with the science of these immunizations, so I will say that. But you had shared just what great shape we're in for our numbers, and I know you do it in other venues, but let's do it briefly here. Like, this is a pretty cool time for Alaska, right? For all of us, Native and non-Native.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing time. You know, I was kind of thinking in terms of public health nursing, we had a 100-year celebration in 1993. So if you search the literature, you'll come up with these documents that rose in 1993 regarding celebration of 100 years of public health nursing. And that's got several items along the timeline, you know, items to celebrate or items that shifted healthcare. But in regards to the timeline moving forward, I mean, man, we're going to see COVID on the timeline. One of the things to celebrate there that you're highlighting, Rob, and I appreciate that, is the percentage of Alaska Natives that have received vaccine and that have been offered vaccine. So the tribal healthcare system that we have and enjoy in Alaska, been around for a few decades, is the largest in the United States and serves over 180,000 people. That's just amazing. In terms of the entire state, about 16% of the folks are Alaska Natives, but nearly all of them have been offered vaccine so far. So the percentages are getting there. And in terms of a race, if this were a race in terms of incidence of new cases versus percent of folks that have been vaccinated, I would say that the Alaska Native community is winning that race because so many folks have been vaccinated. That's awesome. So particularly important because, like, one of the main objectives is to keep people from dying these preventable deaths, but also to keep these folks out of the village-based clinics and out of the regional hubs and out of the Anchorage-based hospitals.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it, but I heard after you and I did that session that there was this fascinating parallel between the origins of the Iditarod to get vaccine up to Nome, and apparently some vaccine was delivered by a dog sled for the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. Is that a myth, or did that happen?
Oh, I would say that that's true to be sure, you know, and just kind of leaning on your experiences in the bush, you know that not only are dog sleds still used as transportation in some areas, but snow machines too. So in regards to vaccine distribution during COVID, not only is it an incredibly complex process, what that also means or translates to is if there's a mean of transportation, it has been used to increase access to vaccine in a timely and safe manner. Incredible, really.
The Alaskan version of that movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, boats, dog yeah. sleds, planes, mucklucks, Mickey Mouse boots, warm jackets.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's the same story, just a slightly different context and further north.
I get such a kick out of it. We'll segue again here a little bit. Kind of as promised, I'll share a few things about supplements, and I kind of already have, but since today's topic is where's the yield, then people won't be surprised to hear me mention food as a game changer, but as opposed to eat your veggies, this is going to be a little bit different exercise. So again, people that have felt like, gosh, I wish I could go get supplements, I've got a little homework project for them instead, because in my estimation, as somebody that's been an MD for over 20 years and a functional medicine doctor for over 15, I can say with confidence that if people do the lifestyle things we talk about in sessions 5 and 6, they will be in the 90th percentile of healthy based on the people I see in my practice. And I believe in my heart of hearts, if they go get the foods that have the good stuff in them, then, you know, A, they don't need the supplements, and B, if they round up supplements, the supplements will work better. So the big hitters for mitigation of getting COVID, being, you know, resistant to its nasty effects while infected and having a better outcome, good recovery, vitamin C helps the immune system. It's good antioxidant, good anti-inflammatory, concentrates itself in the adrenal glands, which are our stress response organs. Zinc, game changer in the actual manufacture of various components of the immune system. Selenium, cousin to zinc in terms of its benefits. Mushrooms in natural medicine are called tonics because they always push the immune system in the right direction. Easily available. A lot of people here harvest their own chaga and make chaga tea. But mushrooms are very, very safe for the vast majority of people. Living food, we talked during the Christy Carrot Tommy Tomato episode about yogurt, kefir, kombucha, kimchi, sauerkraut, certain kinds of pickling have living organisms in them. And then foods of every variety have phytonutrients. Red has different benefits than orange, than blue and purple, than white and yellow. And so if people do that homework project, you find foods with vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, selenium. Get a hold of some mushrooms, eat living food, eat every color every day, and skip the processed stuff, do whole food, make it themselves. That, in my estimation, is more powerful than supplements, but also I think it's a much more resonant and important message for what we want to do on this show, is we want to make this feel like this is in reach of everyone. And I love it that different cultural traditions can access that in different ways, because it's going to be a different project if you're a native person or of Scandinavian descent, or you moved here from Chicago, but everyone can do those sorts of things. And then I wanted people to know that something I see over and over and over again is people think, gosh, if I had access to those supplements, that would be a game changer. And I love supplements. They're a big part of my practice. But here's what I want people to know. You cannot supplement your way out of a suboptimal lifestyle. I have seen people run the experiment. I know firsthand, lifestyle's where it's at. So sleep, social connection, stress management, whole food, and movement. This is where our health comes from. When people work on those domains, they shift into health. If they add supplements, it amplifies or magnifies benefit. But if you flip it and people aren't moving, they're not socially connected, don't have a whole food plan, stress has taken over and they're not sleeping, they can consume an ocean of supplements until the cows come home and they just disappear into a black hole. So a couple thoughts there on where's the yield.
Wow, that's brilliant. You know, what comes to mind when you were talking about that is the commonality or common roots or common determinants of public health problems. You know, there's this particular diagram. It's called a fish diagram, and it was made by created by Ishikawa. And the whole kind of point of the diagram, it has a head of it, and then the tail and ribs kind of look just like a salmon. If you've seen a salmon that's spawned and it's been sitting on the beach for, you know, several months, you'll find just the skeleton remains. And within this particular model, the head represents the public health problem, and then the spine and each of the ribs is a way to outline the determinants of the outcomes associated with that public health problem. Now, the interesting thing is that if you were to replace that head with a different public health problem, what you'll find is many public health challenges have common roots. And so that kind of came up to me when you were thinking about that. So I think that as we continue through COVID and we're looking at post-COVID in our approaches to improving community health, but also individual and family health, I think we'll have an opportunity to have new creative and more fruitful ways of improving health. And one way might be to continue pointing at those commonalities or common roots. So the idea there being is if we were to assess community health and identified several problems, we may be able to work on improving several of them by getting at the roots or the root causes that are common amongst many or all public health problems. But I think it's worth noting here, too, that's kind of a negative-based approach, and that's valid. But you could also put community health resilience at the head of the fish, or resilience factors for a community, family, or individual, and work just the same.
It's cool because it makes it so high yield to work in those common areas. And I think, I don't know that we've talked about it too much, but a fair number of the people that I talk to, whether it's, you know, food confusion or exercise confusion, or there's just this overwhelm feeling. I'm like, what matters?
Right? Like, oh yeah.
You know, I would take action, but I read so much. And again, sometimes it's a great frustration for people who decide, well, I'm going to go out and get, you know, educated on these things. And then they feel like, well, now I've got 100 things in my brain and 50 of them conflict and different experts are saying different things. But these roots, one reason we have talked about this, one reason they're sort of tricky to advocate for is they're basically the way our grandparents lived if they were healthy. You know, they got a good sleep, they ate out of their garden, they you know, they played cards with friends on the weekends, and they weren't on their iPhone because they didn't have iPhones. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, I think in some ways this can make things easier. You know, one litmus test for a food plan is this the way, if your grandmother or grandfather, you know, was raised on a farm or in a healthy setting, like, are you eating the way they would have? Are you making recipes? Are you relaxing? Are you laughing and playing? Are you singing? You know, are you part of your spiritual or friendship community, whatever that is? Mm-hmm. And I like it that it kind of challenges us to say at the very root, when we go down there, what do we see when we ask ourselves how much or how little of that's happening? And then all of the mind-blowing science, the hundreds and thousands of papers that are coming out that are saying these are the roots of our health or lack thereof.
That's far out. When you're speaking about an individual thinking about, oh, should I eat this food or that food, and then I need to exercise, and there's all these components, I can relate directly, you know, from a population-focused perspective. You know, in the world of assessing a community or answering the question, what's the health status of the community at any one point in time? It's a challenge because you're like, how would I even start to assess that? I run the risk of like, what if I focus too much on transportation, or if I zoom way in on healthcare only, then I'm setting myself up for chances to miss the rest of the story. And so that's why community health needs assessments. Oftentimes the approach is to use a prescriptive framework. And a prescriptive framework, there's many of them out there. Southern Kenai Peninsula partners have chosen one that's called MAP. And the idea is simply to create a comprehensive view of the community health needs at that particular time. And that's particularly important because those points that are included in there also align from a state and national view. And so that's one way of connecting those dots. Very relatable.
Well, another fantastic session, Lauren. I want to thank you for your time today and give people a tickler that week 6 we'll wrap up. We'll talk about long haulers, folks that have post-COVID syndrome, and we'll use it as a chance to say, where do we go from here? I'm Rob Downey, a family practice MD, Institute for Functional Medicine Certified Practitioner. My co-host is Lauren Carroll, Public Health Nurse 3 and Fellow in the Johns Hopkins Masters in Public Health Program. I want to thank Olmers and South Peninsula Hospital for supporting us. Thank our audience for joining us, KBBI for the opportunity. Enjoy that sunshine today, and Lauren, we'll see you and our audience next week, huh?
That sounds great. Thanks, Rob.